When we do go traveling like this to various places of the world, and particularly into the USA, it does reinforce upon us the nature of the world. Of the, you know, you see things on the news, and yet when you start traveling, you start coming in contact with things that you wouldn't necessarily see. And of the trip that we actually made, we had 9 flights altogether, and that means 18 airports. And that's 18 times you're going through the procedures of at least 9 times going through the procedures of the security checks that they have there. And within the airports, as we land and take off, one thing that I did notice is the number of American service people there, all in desert fatigues. They were walking through the airport and moving, presumably going either to or from Iraq. It was quite noticeable just how many there were there, particularly in Atlanta more than the other areas. But in virtually every airport we went through, there were some going through in desert fatigues, either coming back or going to Iraq. And that's both men and women that were doing that. And in going through the various security checks as well, it seems they almost always increase as you go through the airports, particularly in the United States. And I think one incident that occurred, was it Cleveland? No, it was the first one at Atlanta where you first had a massage. But with Judy having a bad back, we were coming out of the airport and going to collect our hand luggage. And I said to Judy, we came past this place where they were doing massage on backs and shoulders and so on, which gives you an indication of the seats on airplanes, but because they're doing a roaring business. And I said, well, would you like to have a massage on your back? He said, yes, I really would. So I said, right, right here, I'll go down and get the luggage, and I'll see you back here. So I narrowly went off down to get the luggage, down to the carousel, found the appropriate carousel, and then found the luggage, went back to go back up to this place where I left Judy, and of course I have to go right through the security checks again, which means going right through, and again, the way you've got to go through is all the any toiletries that you've got cannot go in there, you know, any shampoo or anything like that, you can't take in, or any water or whatever, and you put that in your hand luggage. So I came up to this guy in the security and said, well, what do I do? I mean, can I leave this bag with you? He said, yes, sir. He says, but it'll be blown up. So it's what do you do? You can't go through. So Judy was on one side of the barrier on the flight side, and I was on the other side, and there was no way to get actually through there because I couldn't leave my bags anywhere because they would be removed and blown up, and I couldn't take them through because they have all the toiletries with us, unless I went through all the bags and removed all the toiletries and then gave them and got rid of them completely, and they again, I wouldn't be able to get them again. So I had to page her. So she had a paging to try and to meet me down by the carousel. But that's just one small incident that occurred in a catalogue of things of going through, you know, you're balancing on one foot, trying to take your laptop out of its case, put it separately, take your shoes off at the same time, while everybody else is moving through this kind of conveyor belt, all trying to take your overcoat off, and if you've got a belt with a big buckle, this buckle here would not work going through the security, so the belt's got to come off as well, and you try to hold your hand trousers up with one hand, take your shoes off with the other, and at the same time move through the security line. So it was, just about 9 flights later, we just about got it sussed. But it was, you know, don't wear one of these belts. but it is quite a remarkable process that you have to go through these days, as opposed to a few years ago in going through security. And the latest piece of information, the latest piece of news that has come through this morning, where Saddam Hussein was hanged in Iraq, is merely part of this this process that seems to be happening. And it is a case that it says in the newspaper this morning, it says Saddam Hussein was contemplating the final hours of his life last night after the signing of his execution warrant. Munir Haddad, an Iraqi judge, authorized the attempt to attend the hanging, said all the measures have been done and there's no reason for delay. And he was actually hanged at 6 o'clock their time this morning, which is 3 o'clock our time. So that it is interesting that when you think that he was quite shaken. I think the account here of people who actually watched his final moments, and he will therefore be contemplating what is the next final moment that he will actually be meeting. And the things that he has done certainly is something that we will need to be aware of, that all of us will face ultimately, but it is a sobering time. And certainly, it says here, it says, hanging Saddam will not bring peace to his troubled country. So the execution of Saddam Hussein is supposed to bring closure to one of the most troubled periods in the recent history of the Middle East. But even after the former Iraqi dictator had been granted his wish to face God in serenity, as he wrote in his farewell letter to the Iraqi people, his passing is unlikely to have much impact on the dramatic upheaval that Iraq has suffered since his overthrow. And it is interesting that there was another, I believe it was a suicide bomb, another bombing in Iraq, where the Sunni, which was again the Sunnis who were part of the ruling Ba'ath Party, the Sunnis were attacking the Shias, which are the majority in Iraq, and they blew up. I think it was 17 people died, was it, to this morning, something like that. It's happening every single day, and the idea that this war is winnable in its present form, in the way, in fact, it is progressing, is really something that the West is going to have to come to terms with, because it's not winnable in the present form. Because the only way you can actually defeat the ideology of the Islamic ideology is with another ideology. And the problem is that there is not another ideology that is capable of defeating the Islamic ideology, the Islamic religious ideology. And yes, there are factions within the Islamic ideology, but nevertheless, they have a certain grit that the West simply does not have. And so all the security that we're finding in airports, all the various the army which is moving across into the Middle East, this is not going to be the thing that defeats the Islamic ideology. Another area that we need to be keeping an eye on, particularly in this present confrontation, is the area of Mogadishu and Somalia. Now, Mogadishu and Somalia is on the Horn of Africa. Somalia actually goes across the Horn of Africa, and there's British Somaliland joined with Italian, I think it was, Somalia, to make the Somalia that we've got today. And this has had enormous upheavals. And what has happened now, this is from today's newspaper, it says, cheering crowds line the streets of Mogadishu as the army moves in. It says, Somalia's prime minister arrived in the capital, Mogadishu, at the head of a victory convoy yesterday, hours after the city was abandoned by Islamist rebels who had made it their stronghold. Muhammad Ali Gida drove into town in a heavily armed cavalcade, followed by lorries with loudspeakers blaring patriotic music, to be met by hundreds of well-wishers. Elsewhere in the capital, however, far bigger crowds marched through the streets, chanting slogans against Ethiopia. And it was Ethiopia's armies that actually put this present government back into power again. And they haven't actually put the present government back into power. What they've done is they've opened the doors for the warlords to then gain power again and have the absolute chaos that was there previous to the I think it was around May, where they, just May this year, where the Islamic forces had actually taken control. And it was with the intervention of Ethiopia, which is, you know, Coptic Christian. I mean, again, they're looked upon by the Islamic forces within Mogadishu, within Somalia, as crusaders, the same way as the Americans are looked upon within the Iraq and with the British in Afghanistan as crusaders. Is this force against Islam? And so they're looking in this area as this. Confrontation between what was they perceive as a Christian group against this Islamic group. And whether the Islamic group is Shia or it's Sunni, it makes no difference. It is still one against the other, although they do have the infighting between the two groups, between the Shias and the Sunnis, is as intense as anything that you'll find within from Islam against the Western world. But here they see the intervention of Ethiopia as merely part of that. And the interesting thing is that the Sunni Al-Qaeda forces look upon Mogadishu and look upon that area as the area that they can then influence, probably to the greatest degree, as far as terrorism is concerned, as far as their fight against the West. Now, when we're looking at the West, however, if we just sort of look at some, just remind ourselves of something, over in Deuteronomy chapter 4, what God says to the people that are following the book, be it Jew, be it Christian, or whatever, he says in Deuteronomy 4, verse 5, it says, "Behold, I have taught you statutes and judgments, even as the Eternal my God commanded me, that you should do so in the land where you go to possess it. Keep, therefore, and do them, for this is your wisdom." And the problem is that the Western world, that did have this wisdom in the past, has thrown this wisdom out. And without this wisdom, it doesn't have anything to counter the Islamic threat. And we see it not only in actual armed confrontation, but we see it even within our own countries as well. And we see something which is rising within the midst. Now, prophetically, you are looking at the fact that the Catholic Church will take the lead within Europe and will be the force, the moral force against this Islamic threat. But within the West, there isn't anything there. There's only materialism. There's only evolution, where man is at the top of the list. It's a foolishness. That is not good enough. That will not counteract. Democracy? They don't want democracy. They're not looking at democracy. It says here in verse 6, it says, "For this is your wisdom and your understanding in the sight of the nations, which shall hear of all these statutes and say, surely this great nation is a wise and an understanding people." And that is what is not happening today within the Western world, or within the nations looking at the Western world. They look at what comes out of Hollywood, they look at what comes out of the school systems, and they see something which is they simply don't want. It says, "For what nation is there so great that has God so near to them as the Eternal our God is in all things that we call upon him for?" And God is being kicked out of every institution. The founding fathers of America, who put the freedom of religion into place, the Constitution, which it guarantees that freedom of religion, which is what they were trying to do, and it was very clearly what they're trying to do, has now been taken and twisted into freedom of no religion. In other words, freedom from religion. They've actually taken the Constitution, which gave the freedom of religion, and they made it free. But they have made it now freedom from religion to stop religion being taught in schools. And these laws, and notice what it goes on to say, it says, "And what nation is there so great that has statutes and judgments so righteous as all this law which I set before you this day? Only you take heed to yourself and keep your soul diligently, lest you forget the things which your eyes have seen, and lest you depart from your heart all the days of your life, but you teach them to your sons and to your sons' sons." In other words, if you're going to have this moral fiber, it has got to be taught. And it's got to be taught to your sons and your sons' sons. And it's got to be in the educational institutions. "Especially, notice, the day that you stood before the Eternal your God in Horeb, when the Eternal said to me, 'Gather the people together, and I will make them hear my words, that they may learn to fear me all the days that they shall live upon the earth, and that they may teach their children.'" It is precisely those Ten Commandments, which he mentions here, that they're ripping out of the school systems. That is being taken away from the school system, and instead, you've got this materialistic, this humanistic
these humanistic concepts that are being taught in their stead. And the humanistic concepts and the so-called democracy, which is a farce anyway, it's not democracy, not true democracy, that will not counter what they're finding in Iraq, what they're finding in Iran, what they're finding in Syria. And, I mean, those three areas, the ruling party in Syria is Shiite, as is the majority in Iraq and the majority in Iran. But since the days of Ayatollah Khomeini, I was reading the other day about the difference between the Shiites and the Sunnis, and when it actually occurred after Muhammad's death, and the Sunni majority, which you find within the world, they were the ruling, I think, the caliphs that actually got together and made sure that they were then able to rule, almost not a democratic way, but it's along those lines. It was a democratic within the caliphs themselves. But the Shiites, which the names of Shiite Ali, which is the name when they get the full name, they followed the descendants of Muhammad, and the only problem is those descendants got wiped out, and that's why you get this Mahdi idea, that the Mahdi disappeared. This was the last descendant, and he is going to reappear, and it is his spirit guide that is guiding the Shiites and this Ahmadinejad and all this the area of Iran. So when you look at the nation, you see this confusion amongst the Islamic side, and there is an intense confusion there, but you see the West has lost its way. The West, where it says, especially in the day that you stood before the Eternal, your God, in Horeb, when the Eternal said to me, gather the people together, and I will make them hear my words, and make them learn to fear me all the days that they shall live upon the earth. This is verse 10. And that they may teach their children. And it is precisely that they're not doing, that they're not actually allowing their children to learn these things. So what we can see, I should have organized some of these papers a little bit more. This is from W.F. Deeds, where he says, Muslims can never conform to our ways. He says, in a little noticed passage of his controversial interview with another newspaper, the chief of the general staff, General Sir Richard Dannatt, spoke of the Islamic threat. Quote, I hope it doesn't make undue progress, he said, because there's a moral and a spiritual vacuum in this country. Now, this is from the October paper. But just the comment is that there is a moral and spiritual vacuum, and it is that is being filled. Even on the news last night, when we were watching the news last night, they had this was Channel 5 News, they had a piece that somebody had submitted into the news. Now, why on earth it was in the news, I have no idea at all. But it was the conversion of an individual from being almost like a gangster within London into the Islamic faith. And he was promoting it. He was actually promoting his conversion from being, you know, the dropout school dropout who was into all the drugs and everything else, presumably, within the London gangland culture, into the Muslim faith when he went to university. And he basically has become a Muslim. And it was presented as something which was good and something which is positive. And in some ways it was, because, again, he hasn't got anything else within the country. It says, we cannot do... it says, why do we suppose India had to be partitioned? There was no other way of keeping the peace in that great country. That's the great subcontinent. So it was partitioned between Pakistan and India, because the Hindu and the Muslim peoples could not live together. It wasn't possible. He says, we cannot do that here, but perhaps we should be thinking in terms of a supreme council on which our principal religions, including Islam, would sit and try and resolve misunderstandings. What is never going to work is telling followers of Islam here, you must conform to our ways. Now that's the approach within the Western world. They look upon it and you say, well, we can't say you conform to our ways. And in many ways it's true, because our ways are so alien to anybody who's religious. We are irreligious. If we go across to Numbers, let's have a look in Numbers 15. In Numbers 15. We find here in Numbers 15, I turned to Leviticus 15, right, here we go. Numbers 15, notice in verse 13, it says, all that are born in the country shall do these things after this manner, in offering an offering made by fire of a sweet savour unto the Eternal. And if a stranger sojourn with you, or whoever be among you in your generations, and will offer an offering made by fire of a sweet savour to the Eternal, as you do, so he shall do. In other words, he will work, he will do it exactly the same as if he was somebody in the land, if he was going to go ahead and offer to God. It says, one ordinance shall be both for you of the congregation, and also for the stranger that sojourns with you. An ordinance forever in your generations, as you are, so shall the stranger be before the Eternal. And the Eternal being the one God, being the one God that was worshipped in that time. It was not. So Islam that worships Allah, you don't worship in the Allah, in the way of the Muslim. You worship in the way of the Eternal. That's what it's been saying. It says, one law and one manner shall be for you, and for the stranger that sojourns amongst you. And we notice how this is actually applied. Notice in verse 27. And it says, and if any soul sin through ignorance, verse 27, then he shall bring the she-goat of the first year for a sin offering. And the priest shall make an atonement for the soul that sinned ignorantly, when he sins by ignorance before the Eternal, to make an atonement for him, and it shall be forgiven him. You shall have one law for him that sins throughout ignorance, both for him that is born among the children of Israel, and for the stranger that sojourns among them. So both. It goes on, it says, but the soul that does anything presumptuously, whether he is born in the land or a stranger, the same reproach is the Eternal, and that soul shall be cut off from among his people. Because he has despised the word of the Eternal, and it is that word, it's these laws, this way, that all the nations around about will see and be able to understand that it's a great nation. And that is what has gone. That is what is missing today. And has broken his commandment, that soul shall utterly be cut off, his iniquity shall be upon him. And while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man that gathered sticks on the Sabbath day. And they that found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation, and they put him in ward because it was not declared what should be done to him. And the Eternal said to Moses, the man shall surely be put to death, all the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. And all the congregation brought him outside the camp, stoned him with stones, and he died as the Eternal commanded Moses. So there's one law. And the law, even from what is being, and again, you're looking at the context here, you're looking at the context of even a stranger has got to conform to the laws of the land. Now, this is not actually happening, and the problem is, I mean, every single day we have articles. There's an article in yesterday, it says, how the giraffe got the long neck is not just a tall story, study shows. The first experimental support for the classic evolutionary account of how the giraffe got its long neck is about to be published by scientists. Sounds wonderful, doesn't it? Now, there's all kinds of problems with this, because, you know, what they do is they say, oh, well, it was a deer-like creature that happens to just get its being able to eat the tops of the trees. And the support, the actual report, is just that they did certain studies where they fenced off the bottom of the trees, and they saw how the trees grew with just the giraffes eating the tops. And what did they find? They found things grew at the bottom when the giraffes ate the top. I mean, you know, come on, get a life. But the actual explanation of evolution, of the evidence of the evolution of the giraffe, is not there. You do not find this gradual change of a giraffe with a slightly longer and longer and longer neck within the fossil record. It is not there. And the problems, when the giraffe puts its head down to drink, and the amount of blood pressure that is necessary to pump the blood up to that head that is so much higher, and then the adjustment that has got to be made when that giraffe goes down to drink, how does that evolve in the same way, again, particularly when there is not the evidence there. But that is the God that they worship, that is the God that they're trying to push, that is the alternative that they're trying to give to the world. And Scripture shows very clearly that that alternative, this kind of materialism, this kind of democracy, this thing that they're going to try and take to the world, is totally worthless. It is not going to be successful, and it cannot defeat Islam. It is not going to be possible to defeat Islam. It has got to be coming from a religious source, and the only religious source that is on the world scene at this time is the Catholic Church. And unfortunately, what is prophesied there is anything but benevolent.